At first I thought it might be the assistant's day off, but she soon appeared, busily working with the inventory near the front of the shop. As I left, something in me decided not to go back. It certainly wasn't the haircut. He did an excellent job. It wasn't the barber. He was pleasant, affable, seemed to know his business. It was something more essential than that. There was absolutely no consistency to the experience. The expectations created the first meeting were violated at each subsequent visit. I wasn't sure what to expect, and something in me wanted to be sure. I wanted an experience I could repeat by making the choice to return. The unpredictability said nothing about the barber other than that he was constantly and arbitrarily changing my experience for me. He was in control of my experience, not I. And he demonstrated little sensitivity to the impact of his behavior on me. He was running the business for him, not for me. And by doing so, he was depriving me of the experience of making a decision to patronize his business for my own reasons, whatever they might have been. It didn't matter what I wanted. It didn't matter that I enjoyed the sound of the scissors and somehow equated them with a professional haircut. It didn't matter that I enjoyed being waited on by his assistant. It didn't matter that I enjoyed the experience of having my hair washed before he set to work and that I actually believed it would improve the quality of the haircut. I would have been embarrassed to ask for these things, let alone to give my reasons for wanting them. They were also totally emotional, so illogical. How could I have explained them or justified them without appearing to be a boob? What the barber did was to give me a delightful experience and then each and every time take it away. It reminded me of my first psychology course in college. I recall the professor talking about the burnt child syndrome. This is where a child is alternately punished and rewarded for the same kind of behavior. This form of behavior in a parent can be disastrous to the child. He never knows what to expect or how to act. It can also be disastrous to the customer. The burnt child, of course, has no choice but to stay with the parent, but the burnt customer can go someplace else, and he will. What you do in your model is not nearly as important as doing what you do the same way each and every time. 6. The model will utilize a uniform color, dress, and facilities code. Marketing studies tell us that all consumers are moved to act by the colors and shapes they find in the marketplace. Different consumer groups simply respond differently to specific colors and shapes. Believe it or not, the colors and shapes of your model can make or break your business. Louis Cheskin, founder of the Color Research Institute, wrote about the power of colors and shapes in his book, Why People Buy. Little things that are meaningless from a practical point of view may have great emotional meaning through their symbolism. Images and colors are often great motivating forces. Some time ago, we conducted a study of women shopping in an apparel shop. A young woman wanted to buy a blouse that was available in several colors. She held the blue blouse up to her face and looked into the mirror. She was a blonde, and she knew she looked good in blue. She fingered the red one lovingly. She loved the color, she thought, but she said it was too strong and loud. The salesgirl reminded her that yellow was the fashionable color. She could not make up her mind between the color that she looked best in, the color she liked best, and the color in current fashion, so she settled on a gray blouse. It was reported to me a couple of weeks later that she didn't like the gray blouse. It was dead, she said. She wore it only twice. Some of the other purchasers of blouses permitted one of the inner drives to win. Some bought blouses because the color flattered them. Others chose the color that was in fashion, and some took the color they liked. Each chose a color that satisfied the strongest urge or fulfilled the greatest wish. Just think, all this deep psychology in the mere process of buying a blouse. Your business is the same as the blouse in Cheskin's story. There are colors that work and colors that don't. The colors you show your customer must be scientifically determined and then used throughout your model. On the walls, the floors, the ceiling, the vehicles, the invoices, your people's clothes, the displays, the signs. The model must be thought of as a package for your one and only product, your business. Just as with colors, there are shapes that work and shapes that don't. On your business card, your signs, your logo, your merchandise displays. In one test, Cheskin showed that a triangle produced far fewer sales than a circle, and a crest outproduced both by a significant margin. Imagine sales increased or lost by the choice of a seemingly meaningless shape. The shape of your sign, your logo, the type style used on your business cards will have a significant impact on sales, whether you care to think about it or not. Your prototype must be packaged as carefully as any box of cereal. Before we go on, let's summarize what we've covered so far. Go to work on your business rather than in it. Go to work on your business as if it were the pre-production prototype of a mass-producible product. Think of your business as something apart from yourself, as a world of its own, as a product of your efforts, as a machine designed to fulfill a very specific need, as a mechanism for giving you more life, as a system of interconnecting parts, as a package of cereal, as a can of beans, as something created to satisfy your consumers' deeply held perceived needs, as a place that acts distinctly different from all other places, as a solution to somebody else's problem. Think of your business as anything but a job. Go to work on your business rather than in it, and ask yourself the following questions. How can I get my business to work, but without me? How can I get my people to work, but without my constant interference? How can I systematize my business in such a way that it could be replicated 5,000 times so the 5,000th unit would run as smoothly as the very first? How can I own my business and still be free of it? How can I spend my time doing the work I love to do rather than the work I have to do? If you ask yourself these questions, you'll eventually come face to face with the real problem. You don't know the answers. And that's been the problem all along. But now it should be different, because now you know that you don't know. Now you are ready to look the problem squarely in the face. The problem isn't your business. It never has been. The problem is you. It has always been you, and it will always be you. Until you change, that is. Until you change your perspective about what a business is and how one works. Until you begin to think about your business in a totally new way. Until you accept the undeniable fact that business, even a very small business like yours, is both an art and a science. And like art and like science, to successfully develop a serious business, you need specific information. Most importantly, to successfully develop a serious business, you need a process, a practice by which to obtain that information, and once obtained, a method with which to put that information to use in your business productively. What follows is just such a method. A programmed approach to learning what needs to be learned about your business in order to climb the proverbial ladder. A proven way to the top that has been successfully implemented by tens of thousands of small businesses just like yours. We call it the eMyth Mastery Program, and it's a process that can transform your life. Sarah looked at me thoughtfully for a moment and then said, "Let me describe in my own words what I heard you just say." She folded her hands tightly together before her on the table, and, as if for emphasis, leaned towards me. "What you're saying is that I'm too identified with my business, that I need to separate myself from it, first in the way I think about it, second in the way I feel about it, and third in the way I work in it. And what I also hear you saying is that it is this identification with my business, my technician's need to see the business as nothing more or less than me, that is causing me all of the pain I'm feeling, all of the frustration I experience going to work every day. My belief that if I'm good, the business will be. That if I work hard enough, the business will succeed. That if I'm in touch with everything that goes on in the business, nothing can possibly go wrong. And what I also hear you saying is that in order for me to be free of my frustration, in order to exercise true control over my business, I need to disidentify with my business. I need to conceive of my business in a radically different way than I'm accustomed to. I need to conceive of my business as a product. Just like my pies are a product, I need to think of my business like that. And if I were to think that way, I would suddenly have to ask the question, how must my business as a product work in order for it to successfully attract not only customers, but also employees who want to work here? And the minute I ask that question, I'm already doing business in a totally new way. Sarah paused for a moment, as if to let that last thought truly sink in. "You know," she said quietly, "I can truly say that until this very moment, I had never thought about my business as an idea before. I simply thought of it as a job, a place to go to work. I never even considered that there was another way to think about it. But now it's getting exciting. An entirely new opportunity. Thinking like this reminds me of my first literature class in high school. My teacher was Mr. Rethke, and he had an incredible ability to bring the subject of literature alive. By the time I read the first assignment, it was Huckleberry Finn, I couldn't put the book down. These were real people in the book, living out their lives in real places, overcoming obstacles, terror, love, feelings. Huckleberry Finn came alive to me in that first class like no other book has ever before it. That's what this feels like to me, like we're opening the covers of a new book, not knowing what's inside, but knowing, given the wonderful, rich anticipation that accompanies every new adventure, that nothing will ever be the same again. That's how all this feels to me, that my business will never be the same from this moment on, and neither will I." She pressed her hands together and then leaned back against her chair as if to catch a breath. "And if I understand you correctly, that's what you're calling the franchise prototype. The franchise prototype is the name for my business as a product. It's a way of thinking about my business as one complete thing, a whole, you might say, that looks, acts, and feels in a clearly definable way, apart from me, independent of me. That if I did all this correctly, all about pies could be designed, engineered, and manufactured just like any product is, to operate predictably in such a way that causes everyone to want to buy from it. And because it is so predictably responsive to their needs, they'd keep on coming back for more. And it's my job to design, engineer, and manufacture all about pies until it works perfectly without me having to be here all the time. And while I must admit I'm overwhelmed by the idea of it, it's the most challenging and exciting thought I've had in years. And the great thing is, I've already got the business. All I have to do now is to learn how. Sarah, I said, I couldn't have said it any better. So let's go on to the next step, the business development process. Because what you have to learn is going to be easier than you think. Part 3. Building a Small Business That Works. Chapter 10. The Business Development Process. Tolerance for failure is a very specific part of the excellent company culture, and that lesson comes directly from the top. Champions have to make lots of tries and consequently suffer some failures, or the organization won't learn. Thomas J. Peters and Robert H. Waterman, Jr., In Search of Excellence. Building the prototype of your business is a continuous process, a business development process. Its foundation is three distinct yet thoroughly integrated activities through which your business can pursue its natural evolution. They are innovation, quantification, and orchestration. Innovation. Innovation is often thought of as creativity, but as Harvard professor Theodore Levitt points out, the difference between creativity and innovation is the difference between thinking about getting things done in the world and getting things done. Says Professor Levitt, creativity thinks up new things. Innovation does new things. The franchise revolution has brought with it an application of innovation that has been almost universally ignored by American business. By recognizing that it is not the commodity that demands innovation, but the process by which it is sold, the franchisor aims his innovative energies at the way in which his business does business. To the franchisor, the entire process by which the business does business is a marketing tool, a mechanism for finding and keeping customers. Each and every component of the business system is a means through which the franchisor can differentiate his business from all other businesses in the mind of his consumer. Where the business is the product, how the business interacts with the consumer is more important than what it sells. And the how doesn't have to be expensive to be effective. In fact, some of the most powerful innovations have required little more than the change of a few words, a gesture, the color of clothing. For example, what does the salesperson in a retail store invariably say to the incoming customer? He says, "May I help you?" Have you ever heard that one before? And how does the customer invariably respond? He says, "No thanks, just looking." Have you ever said that one before? Of course you have. In fact, it's a universal phenomenon. Now, why do you suppose the salesperson asks that question when he knows that the customer will respond the way he does? Because the customer responds the way he does. That's why. If the customer is just looking, the salesperson doesn't have to go to work. Can you imagine what these few words are costing retailers in this country in lost sales? Here's a perfect opportunity to try a simple and inexpensive innovation. The innovation. Instead of asking, "Hi, may I help you?" try this instead. "Hi, have you been in here before?" The customer will respond with either a yes or a no. In either case, you're then free to pursue the conversation. If the answer is yes, you can say, "Great, we've created a special new program for people who've shopped here before. Let me take just a minute to tell you about it." If the answer is no, you can say, "Great, we've created a special new program for people who haven't shopped here before. Let me take just a minute to tell you about it. Of course, you'll have to have created a special new program to talk about in either case, but that's the easy part. Just think a few simple words. Nothing fancy, but the result is guaranteed to put money in your pocket. How much? That depends on how enthusiastically you do it. The experience of our retail clients tells us that by doing this one thing alone, sales will increase between 10 and 16% almost immediately. Can you believe it? A few simple words and sales instantly go up, not by just a little bit, mind you, but by a considerable amount. What would you do for a 10 to 16% increase in sales? The innovation. Again, for salespeople, a 6-week test. For the first 3 weeks, wear a brown suit to work, a starched tan shirt, a brown tie for men, and well-polished brown shoes. Make certain that all the elements of your suit are clean and well-pressed. For the following 3 weeks, wear a navy blue suit, a good starched white shirt, a tie with red in it, a pin or a scarf with red in it for women, and highly polished black shoes. The result will be dramatic. Sales will go up during the second 3-week period. Why? Because, as our clients have consistently discovered, blue suits outsell brown suits, and it doesn't matter who's in them. Is it any wonder that McDonald's, Federal Express, Disney, Mrs. Fields Cookies, and many more extraordinary companies spend so much time and money on determining how they look? It pays. And it pays consistently, over and over and over again. The innovation. The next time you want somebody to do something for you, touch him softly on the arm as you ask him to do it. You'll be amazed to find that more people will respond positively when you touch them than when you don't. Again, to apply this to your business, you or your salespeople should make a point of touching each customer on the elbow, arm, or back sometime during the sales process. You will find, as our clients have found, that there'll be a measurable increase in sales. Innovation is the heart of every exceptional business. Innovation continually poses the question, what is standing in the way of my customer getting what he wants from my business? For the innovation to be meaningful, it must always take the customer's point of view. At the same time, innovation simplifies your business to its critical essentials. It should make things easier for you and your people in the operation of your business. Otherwise, it's not innovation, but complication. Innovation, then, is the mechanism through which your business identifies itself in the mind of your customer and establishes its individuality. It is the result of a scientifically generated and quantifiably verified profile of your customer's perceived needs and unconscious expectations. It is the skill developed within your business and your people that is constantly asking, what is the best way to do this? Knowing, even as the question is asked, that we will never discover the best way, but by asking, we will assuredly discover a way that's better than the one we know now. In that regard, I think of innovation as the best way skill. It produces a high level of energy in every company within which it's nurtured, fed, and stimulated. Energy that in turn feeds everyone the company touches, its employees, customers, suppliers, and lenders. In an innovative company, everyone grows. There's no doubt about it. Innovation is the signature of a bold, imaginative hand. Quantification. But on its own, innovation leads nowhere. To be at all effective, all innovations need to be quantified. Without quantification, how would you know whether the innovation worked? By quantification, I'm talking about the numbers related to the impact an innovation makes. For example, ask any group of small business owners how many selling opportunities they had the day before, as we have at eMyth Worldwide day after day, and I promise you 99% of them will not know the answer. The sad fact is that quantification is not being done in most businesses, and it's costing them a fortune. For example, how would you know that by changing the words you use to greet an incoming customer, you produced a 16% increase in sales, unless you quantified it by, first, determining how many people came in the door before the innovation was put into effect. Second, determining how many people bought products and what the dollar value of those products were before you changed the words and what you said to produce those sales. Third, counting the number of people who came in the door after you changed the words. Four, counting the number of people who purchased something. Five, determining the average unit value of a sale. And six, determining what the improvement was as a result of your innovation. These numbers enable you to determine the precise value of your innovation. How would you know that wearing a blue suit had a specific monetary impact on your business unless you quantified that impact and had a specific control against which to measure it? The answer is obvious. You wouldn't. And as I've said, few small business owners do quantify these things, even those who believe in quantification. Because few small business owners believe that such apparently insignificant innovations are really that important. But ask yourself, if you could increase sales 10% by doing something as simple as wearing a blue suit, would you do it? Would you make it important? The answer is as obvious as the question is ridiculous. Of course you would. And it is the obvious that must be addressed by quantification at the outset of the business development process. I mean everything. How many customers do you see in person each day? How many in the morning? In the afternoon? How many people call your business each day? How many call to ask for a price? How many want to purchase something? How many of product X are sold each day? At what time of day are they sold? How many are sold each week? Which days are busiest? How busy? And so forth. You can't ask too many questions about the numbers. Eventually, you and your people will think of your entire business in terms of the numbers. You'll quantify everything. You'll be able to read your business's health chart by the flow of the numbers. You'll know which numbers are critical and which are not. You'll become as familiar with your business's numbers as your doctor is with your blood pressure and pulse rates. Because without the numbers, you can't possibly know where you are, let alone where you're going. With the numbers, your business will take on totally new meaning. It will come alive with possibilities. Orchestration. Once you innovate a process and quantify its impact on your business, once you find something that works better than what preceded it, once you discover how to increase the yeses from your customers, your employees, your suppliers, and your lenders, at that point, it's time to orchestrate the whole thing. Orchestration is the elimination of discretion or choice at the operating level of your business. Without orchestration, nothing could be planned and nothing anticipated by you or your customer. If you're doing everything differently each time you do it, if everyone in your company is doing it by their own discretion, their own choice, rather than creating order, you're creating chaos. As Theodore Levitt says in his stunning book, Marketing for Business Growth, discretion is the enemy of order, standardization, and quality. If a blue suit works, wear it every single time you're in front of a customer, is the dictum of the disciples of orchestration. If "Hi, have you been in here before?" works better than anything else you've tried, say it every single time you greet a customer, is the rule of the day from the disciples of orchestration. By every disciple of orchestration, I'm referring to anyone who has ever seriously decided to produce a consistent, predictable result in the world of business, no matter what business they are in. Whether that be Fred Smith at Federal Express, Tom Watson at IBM, Ray Kroc at McDonald's, Walt Disney at Disney, Debbie and Randy Fields at Mrs. Fields Cookies, or whomever, throughout the course of time. Because every founder of every great business format franchise company, whether it is franchised or not, knows one thing to be true. If you haven't orchestrated it, you don't own it. And if you don't own it, you can't depend on it. And if you can't depend on it, you haven't got a franchise. And without a franchise, no business can hope to succeed. If, by a franchise, you understand that I'm talking about a proprietary way of doing business that differentiates your business from everyone else's. In short, the definition of a franchise is simply your unique way of doing business. And unless your unique way of doing business can be replicated every single time, you don't own it. You have lost it. And once you've lost it, you're out of business. The need for orchestration is based on the absolutely quantifiable certainty that people will do only one thing predictably, and that is to be unpredictable. But for your business to be predictable, your people must be. Then what? Then the system must provide the vehicle to facilitate predictability. To do what? To give your customer what he wants every single time. Why? Because unless your customer gets everything he wants every single time, he'll go someplace else to get it. Orchestration is the glue that holds you fast to your customer's perceptions. Orchestration is the certainty that's absent from every other human experience. It is the order and the logic behind the human craving for reason. Orchestration is as simple as doing what you do, saying what you say, looking like you look, being how and who you are, for as long as it works, for as long as it produces the results you want. And when it doesn't work any longer, change it. The business development process is not static. It's not something you do and then are done with. It's something you do all the time. In other words, once you've innovated, quantified, and orchestrated something in your business, you must continue to innovate, quantify, and orchestrate it. The business development process is dynamic simply because the world, moving as it does, will not tolerate a stationary object. The world will collide with whatever you've created and sooner or later destroy it. The business development process is that which enables you to preempt the world's changes. It hopefully precedes them, anticipates them, and if not, at least is infinitely flexible in relationship to them. In short, innovation, quantification, and orchestration are the backbone of every extraordinary business. They are the essence of your business development process. "I need you to help me with something," Sarah said, a look of concern on her face. "I need help coming to grips with this whole subject of orchestration. It sounds so mechanical, so deadening." When I think of it, I picture a shop full of people working dispassionately, each of them doing things in identically the same way, like robots. Certainly you can't be saying that. But I don't know how else to think about it. She paused with uncertainty, but then, as though deciding she had made her point, grew quiet and waited for my answer. "Sarah," I began softly, "if the business development process were only about orchestration, I would agree with you. It would be deadly. Absent a higher purpose, all habits are deadly. Because that's all orchestration really is, Sarah, a habit, a way of doing something habitually. The problem is you can't understand the value of an entire process by separating it from its parts, or its parts from the process. Because once you separate the parts of a process, once you take a process apart, there is no process. There is no movement whatsoever. There is only this thing or that. There is no beginning, no middle, no end. There is no story. There's only an event frozen in time. You might say that apart from its process, the part of a process is dead. So when you think of orchestration absent innovation and quantification, you're describing an action stripped of its purpose, its meaning, its vitality. No, to fully understand the role any action or any piece of work plays in the business as a whole, you have to see it as a part of the whole, not as a thing in itself. Let me show you what I mean. Think back to your aunt's kitchen. Think about the process of baking a pie. Certainly, when you remember the entire process you and your aunt went through, you remember much more than any single part of it. Isn't that true? Sarah smiled warmly, reliving the experience in her aunt's kitchen. Yes, of course that's true, she responded. It all melts together into a sensation, you might say, into a picture, and smells and movements and things fused together with my aunt's remarks and her laughter and her hands doing the things they did on the cutting board. Exactly the opposite of what I imagine orchestration to be, she said firmly. In fact, that's what was so special to me about the kitchen. The creativity of it all. The continuous stream of surprises. But think about it, Sarah. Is that really true? Wasn't there a specific way your aunt taught you to cut the fruit? A specific way to hold it? A specific way to prepare it? Wasn't there a specific way to do everything your aunt taught you to do? And wasn't the creativity, the continuous stream of surprises, a result not just of the specific work you were doing, but of your continuous and exhilarating experience of improving as you learned how to do these very specific tasks better and better until you could do them almost as well as your aunt? Wasn't that where the joy came from? That if you were resigned to doing one thing, one way, forever, without ever improving, there would be no joy. There'd only be the same deadening routine. And isn't that what your aunt taught you as she taught you to bake pies, the mystery that change can bring? So of course there needs to be orchestration, Sarah. There needs to be a way we do something. There needs to be a set routine. Because without it, there would be nothing to improve upon. And without improvement, there'd be no reason to be. We would be machines, or as you called them, robots. There would be the tyranny of routine. There'd be the monotony and the boredom you so eloquently describe. But with the process, with the continuous innovation and quantification that precedes the orchestration and that follows it, with this continuous investigation into the way of work, the work itself becomes key to our own personal transformation. The work itself becomes something other than a habit. It becomes an exploration into who we are and how we express ourselves in relationship to something much larger. First, the position we fill. Then the function it fills. then the business within which the function fulfills both itself and the business, without which it wouldn't exist. Then the world within which the business fulfills its purpose, as well as the purpose of the people with whom and for whom it comes into contact. And so on and so forth. What I've just described is the thrill of apprenticeship. The learning and growing that you experienced in the kitchen under your aunt's tutelage. That's one level of experience, but there are more. A second kind of experience is when you begin to develop a certain level of mastery of the orchestrated skills your aunt introduced you to. Mastery that comes from your practice. That's the mastery of the craftsperson. The craftsperson develops a knowingness about the work she does that bears its own fruit, the fruit of being present or attentive. The craftsperson learns that within the work she does, there is a jewel hiding below the surface. That the thrill of the craft is to discover the jewel, and that there is only one way to discover it, to practice the craft mindlessly. To become one with the work. To polish and polish as though with one's heart. That there is no way to know when the jewel will show itself, but to trust with all one's heart that one day, when it is least expected, the jewel will be there. It will appear. And so the craftsperson is one who has reached that stage of her development where she is content with the work and only the work, knowing that it is only through being there with one's work that the jewel will reveal itself, and that it is the work and only the work raised to the level of near perfection that connects the craftsperson with herself, with her own heart. And so she practices, day in and day out, content to do so, without the thrill of the apprentice to keep her going, but knowing, deep inside, that there is no place to go but here. Unlike the apprentice's stage, the craftsperson's stage is long and relatively serene until that day when the jewel does appear, and with it, a stunning explosion of light enraptures the craftsperson and brings with it mastery. You've seen mastery before, Sarah. You've seen it in your aunt's face, in her eyes, in the way she spoke to you. For the master, there is only one way, and that is to teach another. The master is connected to the apprentice as though to her past, as you are to your childhood. The master knows that the process of growing, of change, of transformation is always moving, never still. It is in the face of the apprentice that the master sees herself anew. It is in the face of the craftsperson that the master renews her pilgrimage and finds the beauty of giving herself up to work. It is in the face of the work that the master discovers anew why she is so enraptured, and in doing so, brings her rapture to the apprentice to start all over again. In much the same way, orchestration builds upon that which preceded it, and becomes the foundation for that which is about to follow, and in the process, honors the past, the present, and the future. To me, Sarah, that is what the business development process is all about. It is a search within which the very ordinary things we must do from day to day are the essential hub of the wheel around which the search moves. On a more practical level, what we've experienced in our work with small businesses is that as the business development process becomes an integral part of the business, it also becomes an integral part of the communication between the participants. It becomes not only a way of thinking and a way of doing, but a way of being as well. You might say that while going to work on the business, people begin to realize that it is a powerful metaphor for going to work on their lives. And that, I believe, is the heart of the process. Not efficiency, not effectiveness, not more money, not to downsize or get lean, but to simply and finally create more life for everyone who comes into contact with the business. But most of all, for you, the person who owns it. So I obviously feel passionately about the subject. What you call it doesn't really matter. Call it the business development process, re-engineering, TQM, excellence, or Kaizen. The entire subject becomes a desultory process if it doesn't address the hearts and minds and souls of people. Quality is just a word, and an empty word at that, if it doesn't include harmony, balance, passion, intention, and attention. Continuous improvement for its own sake is a waste of time. Life is what a business is about, and life is what this work is about. Coming to grips with oneself in the face of an incredibly complex world that can teach us if we're open to learn. In this way, the business development process can be thought of as a metaphor for personal transformation, for coming to grips with real life, for developing real skills within a structure of your own design, for understanding the dynamics of change, of value, of communication, of thought. It's an idea that we at eMyth Worldwide have learned to manifest in the practical world. It is a philosophy. It is a cosmology. It is whatever you wish it to be. But what it is, in the end, is an opportunity to fulfill whatever is fulfillable in the place you find yourself now, and in any future place you could occupy with enough imagination and enough of a wish. I suddenly became aware that I'd been going on without checking in with Sarah. I've been known to do that at times. I'm sorry, Sarah. I got carried away with the idea and the sound of my own voice. Do you have any specific questions? Can I be more specific? Sarah touched my hands on the table and said, "My head is full of questions, but somehow I think you're going to answer them. I just want to thank you for doing what you just did. If you don't mind, could we go on and talk about how all this works?" I took a sip of tea and went on. Chapter 11, Your Business Development Program. And I say to ye all, good friends, that as ye grow in gulf, ye come to see the things ye learn there in every other place, the grace that comes from such a discipline, the extra feel in the hands, the extra strength and knowing, all those special powers ye felt from time to time begin to enter our lives. Michael Murphy, Gulf in the Kingdom. Now you understand the task ahead. To think of your business as though it were the prototype for 5,000 more just like it. To imagine that someone will walk through your door with the intention of buying your business, but only if it works. And only if it works without a lot of work and without you to work it. Imagine yourself at that moment. Imagine your smile inside as you say, "Let me show you how it works." Knowing that not only will it work, but it will work better than any other business he's ever seen. Imagine yourself taking the potential buyer through your business, explaining each component and how it works with every other component. How you've innovated system solutions to people problems. How you've quantified the results of those innovations. And how you've orchestrated the innovations so that they produce the same results every single time. Imagine yourself introducing the potential buyer of your business to your people and standing by while they proudly explain their accountabilities to the fascinated stranger. Imagine how impressed the potential buyer of your business would be upon being presented with such order, such predictability, such irreproachable control. Imagine the results of your business development program. Your business development program is the step-by-step process through which you convert your existing business, or the one you're about to create, into a perfectly organized model for thousands more just like it. Your business development program is the vehicle through which you can create your franchise prototype. The program is composed of 7 distinct steps. Step 1, your primary aim. Step 2, your strategic objective. Step 3, your organizational strategy. Step 4, your management strategy. Step 5, your people strategy. Step 6, your marketing strategy. And step 7, your systems strategy. Let's get started. Chapter 12, Your Primary Aim. The chief characteristic of the volitional act is the existence of a purpose to be achieved, the clear vision of an aim. Robert Assagioli, The Act of Will. I doubt that by now you'd be surprised to find out that I don't believe your business to be the first order of business on our agenda. You are. Nor will you be surprised to hear that I don't believe your business is your life, although it does and can play a significantly important role in your life. But before you can determine what that role will be, you must ask yourself these questions. What do I value most? What kind of life do I want? What do I want my life to look like, to feel like? Who do I wish to be? Your primary aim is the answer to all these questions. Consider it from another perspective. I'd like you to imagine that you're about to attend one of the most important occasions of your life. It will be held in a room sufficiently large to seat all of your friends, your family, your business associates, anyone and everyone to whom you are important and who's important to you. Can you see it? The walls are draped with deep golden tapestries. The lighting is subdued, soft, casting a warm glow on the faces of your expectant guests. Their chairs are handsomely upholstered in a golden fabric that matches the tapestries. The golden carpeting is deeply piled. At the front of the room is a dais, and on the dais, a large, beautifully decorated table with candles burning at either end. On the table, in the center, is the object of everyone's attention, a large, shining, ornate box. And in the box is you, stiff as a proverbial board. Do you see yourself lying in the box, not a dry eye in the room? Now, listen. From the four corners of the room comes a tape recording of your voice. Can you hear it? You're addressing your guests. You're telling them the story of your life. How would you like that story to go? That's your primary aim. What would you like to be able to say about your life after it's too late to do anything about it? That's your primary aim. If you were to write a script for the tape to be played for the mourners at your funeral, how would you like it to read? That's your primary aim. And once you've created the script, all you need to do is to make it come true. All you need to do is to begin living your life as if it were important. All you need to do is to take your life seriously, to create it intentionally, to actively make your life into the life you wish it to be. Simple? Yes. Easy? No. but absolutely essential if your business is to have any meaning beyond work. Because if your business is going to become an integral part of that tape, if your business is going to make a major contribution to the realization of your dream, if your business is going to become a significant component of your primary aim, you have to let your business know what that aim is. And how can you expect to do that if you don't know what it is? Do you see why your primary aim is so important to the success of your business? With no clear picture of how you wish your life to be, how on earth can you begin to live it? How would you know what first step to take? How would you measure your progress? How would you know where you were? How would you know how far you had gone? How would you know how much farther you had yet to go? Without your primary aim, you wouldn't. Indeed, you couldn't. It would be virtually impossible. As with mature companies, I believe great people to be those who know how they got where they are and what they need to do to get where they're going. Great people have a vision of their lives that they practice emulating each and every day. They go to work on their lives, not just in their lives. Their lives are spent living out the vision they have of their future in the present. They compare what they've done with what they intended to do. And where there's a disparity between the two, they don't wait very long to make up the difference. They go to work on their lives, not just in their lives. I believe it to be true that the difference between great people and everyone else is that great people create their lives actively, while everyone else is created by their lives, passively waiting to see where life takes them next. The difference between the two is the difference between living fully and just existing. The difference between the two is living intentionally and living by accident. Let me repeat once more that great quote by Don Juan in Carlos Castaneda's A Separate Piece. The difference between a warrior and an ordinary man is that a warrior sees everything as a challenge, while an ordinary man sees everything as either a blessing or a curse. So before you start your business or before you return to it tomorrow, ask yourself the following questions. What do I wish my life to look like? How do I wish my life to be on a day-to-day basis? What would I like to be able to say I truly know in my life, about my life? How would I like to be with other people in my life, my family, my friends, my business associates, my customers, my employees, my community? How would I like people to think about me? What would I like to be doing 2 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, when my life comes to a close? What specifically would I like to learn during my life, spiritually, physically, financially, technically, intellectually, about relationships? How much money will I need to do the things I wish to do? By when will I need it? These are just a few of the questions you might ask yourself in the creation of your primary aim. The answers become the standards against which you can begin to measure your life's progress. In the absence of such standards, your life will drift aimlessly, without purpose, without meaning. In that regard, your primary aim is the vision necessary to bring your business to life and your life to your business. It provides you with a purpose. It provides you with energy. It provides you with the grist for your day-to-day mill. That's what's been missing in my business, Sarah all but shouted. Me! How could I have been so oblivious to something so obvious? Don't be so hard on yourself, I said. We're all oblivious. Join the club. Let me tell you a story. There was once a young man who had recently turned 40, whose life seemed to be going nowhere. Somehow, he'd never grabbed hold of a career. His life had no purpose. College had somehow eluded him. In his first year at UCLA, he couldn't find anything to hold his attention, and he quit. He studied music as a boy. Many said brilliant.